What's your middle name, Maud?
I can never tell it.
Well, I won't tell it.
E.
What is that, Elizabeth?
Just E.
Maud E. Odom Ford.
Right.
Okay. Now, Maud, you were born here, weren't you?
No.
You were born before your parents came here?
I was born in Alabama.
You were born before they came here.
Okay. Right.
Well, how old were you when they came here?
7.
So you've been here since you were 7 years old. And of course, you are the third child.
Mm-hmm.
Your older sister, was that the one I just met?
Probably, because she lives in Detroit.
She is the older one.
Mm-hmm.
What's her name?
Josie. Morris.
Morris, okay. And then next team?
Earlene.
And of course, Earlene lives here. That's Earlene
Patterson.
And then you have a brother.
Albert
Odom. Doesn't he live in Detroit?
Ann Arbor,
okay. And that's four?
Four. Oh. We have an adopted brother.
Yeah.
Lorenzo.
This is Lorenzo's dad. Or is this Lorenzo?
This is Lorenzo, who is the one that work in your church.
Yeah.
That's my adopted brother.
I didn't realize he was your dad. I knew he was a cousin. Yeah, he was a cousin, really.
Mm-hmm. He's a first cousin, but we adopted him.
Good, that's nice. I like
that. So he's our brother also.
Oh, good. Now, Maud, you have been around Ypsilanti long enough to have observed many things. And, of course, since your arrival here, there have been a lot of changes. And I guess what I'd like to have you tell me is some of the changes that you have observed, at least from your vantage point, first being a child growing up here, and second from a person being in field education.
Well, I think probably more people have gone toward trades or education more so than when I was a child. And housing patterns, of course, have changed. Attitudes in the city has changed. Therefore, we're seeing, of course, people, city government, school, district, all of the elements of, the city, you've seen involvement on all parts without any question and without any controversy, actually. Other than that, I don't really see that many great changes.
Well,
which are very important.
The changes have been subtle, I guess. And they have come in such a way in Ypsilanti until they're really not made a lot of splashes.
Right. Ypsilanti is, I think, the type of town that you don't hear a lot of controversy. People will say today, like for instance, I remember a banker telling me and my husband that they would never lend money for a black person or minority persons in general to build or buy a house across Michigan Avenue. And that same bank financed a lot of houses today, and that was within like a 3-4 year period when that statement was made, that the change was there. And there was no big controversy about it. It's just that you had to have someone break the barrier. And once the barrier was broken, that was it.
Tell me something, and this is not the first time I've heard that statement. Without going into names, in that period of change, did the person who was making these refusals, did he step down or out and somebody else step in?
No, he was there. He was there when the changes were made. He was the president of the bank, and he was still president when the changes were made. But it's just people went ahead and pushed for the progress anyway. And this bank just didn't want to be left behind. So that same banker, I know, in fact, that same bank financed our house when we built our house across Michigan Avenue.
Yeah.
So.
Well, no, it's interesting because in 60 or 70, when Luke and I were trying to buy we went to both banks and we were refused.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that could have been other reasons. We were new.
Mm-hmm.
And we went to Detroit and got our clients. And that was in 1970, spring 1970. And of course, now, with no problem. Other thing I remember is Johnny Barfield talking about the fact that he went to a local banker who was still here and he was still very much, I know him, he knows him, everybody knows, but he went to this banker, he says, when he was just starting off in business and wanted to borrow some money to buy his wife a coat for Christmas, and he was going
to. Oh yeah, that was the problem.
And he went, but when he borrowed $500,000 a few months ago, he borrowed that from the other banks.
Now, those were the problems, and I guess they were problems that were being faced all over. So I never looked upon Ypsilanti as being unique, and I never really held that, you know, as something to make me upset or angry, because it was just that way at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So I, like now, I take the good times with, you know, the progress that we've made, the same as I took those times when we weren't really in the driver's seat for making the project. So I've never really had any uptight feelings about it.
Would you agree that perhaps a difference in Ypsilanti and some other places, including Ann Arbor, was in comparison with other places in this area, Ypsilanti was perhaps more liberal in its feelings and in its treatment of blacks than were some of the other places?
I couldn't really say, because I never was that involved in other areas.
Mm-hmm.
I do feel that black people in Ypsilanti has made more progress than even Ann Arbor, who is supposedly more influential and affluent. I think that if you weigh it, you find more black businesses. We used to think that all the educated people were in Ann Arbor, black educated people. That's not true. And I think it was just a myth, because Ann Arbor was a city that had money and has money compared to Ypsilanti, say. It wasn't just black-white even. It was just Ann Arbor against Ipsy,
yeah.
Because when we were in school, we were all, Ann Arbor was our greatest rival.
Yeah, yeah.
In reality, Ann Arbor still is the greatest rival, you know, so it's just, you're a joining city, and it just happened to be one of those cities that's a little bit more affluent. I do feel perhaps that we've made more progress as black people in Ypsilanti than the Ann Arbor blacks have.
Do you realize that up until 1950, the black population of Ypsilanti was greater than that of Ann Arbor?
Oh yeah, I agree. Because when blacks migrated north, they could easily get housing or placement in Ypsilanti than they could going to Ann Arbor. Blacks were all in one little pocket, and it was a small pocket in Ann Arbor.
And about the only thing they could do was were in service types of occupation.
Right, right. And whereas here, our people more or less went into factories,
yeah,
or whatever. We accepted it that way.
Mm.
Yeah.
Well, that's just one of the things that I have noticed since I've been involved in this thing. Of course, you mentioned one thing, one aspect that I'm quite concerned about, and that is business. From the very beginning, the first settler here went into business.
Right. I would agree with that.
A man came here in 1840. And opened up a barbershop before he ever moved to town. There has always been the black business in Ypsilanti. Up until about 1885, the leading grocery store in Ypsilanti was black. There was a family who was the leading well diggers and so forth. The Bow family had the grocery store, and then the Bow family also went into the house moving And they were house movers down to about 1930.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Elijah McCoy's father was in the cigar making business. And that was, well, he was able to send his son to Scotland to go to school because he was making money. I guess the thing I'm leading up to is I want you to tell me about businesses that you remember since you've been here.
Well, there was, of course, the co-op store on Jefferson.
Oh, that's a new one.
And,
co-op store.
Right. That was Mrs. Dorsey and Mr. Francois. It was a whole group of people. It was a cooperation that opened up this grocery store.
Where was it?
On Jefferson Street. Right on the corner of Jefferson and, what is that cross street there? Jefferson and, I can't think of the little street that crossed there.
There's Catherine, there's...
No, Jefferson, up south of Perry School.
Oh, up there. Oh, I got you. Okay.
And that was a very active grocery store.
Yeah.
And, then, of course, Mr. Mays had a beautiful, built from the ground store there on Monroe Street, grocery store.
Is that the father of the, Mays, Trent Mays, Mays in the barbershop?
Or no,
Mays who's
no.
In Lansing?
No, no. They might be related, but I don't think so. Then there was a Mr. Shackelford, and he had a grocery store on Monroe Street. Then, of course, we had barbershops. At the time, most of them sometimes were in the homes, but then they started to build, like on Harriet Street, they started to build the barbershops.
And, when you came here, concerning barbershops, when you came here, around the time you came here, were there still barbershops downtown primarily serving whites?
As far as I know, they all were when I came here.
Well, the first barbershops, of course, served whites exclusively. First one.
Well, to my knowledge, all of them when I came here downtown were serving white. Mm-hmm. I don't know any that served black when I came here. There might have been, but I wasn't at... My father had some man who cut his hair, I never thought about it one way or the other.
Yeah.
And the man cut my brother's hair, so mm-hmm. Otherwise I'm not sure. I knew my Uncle Elmer used to cut hair in his house, mm-hmm. Elmer Robeson, and other people that used to cut hair in their houses. So mm-hmm. Then, of course, Mr. Pete Brooks had the gas station.
That was over there.
Huron.
Huron, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And there was another person who ran a gas station, and I can't remember who it was. Can't remember who that person was. But there was another gas station, I know. But that's about all that I remember as far as established black businesses. And those businesses were well established at that time.
Dickerson was gone when you came.
Yes. Okay. He was dead when I came. At the time, of course, Dr. Perry was the dentist here. And then... Dr. Bass came right after we were here. And then, of course, there was Dr. Jefferson who came, and he ran his dental office up in the old Dr. Dickerson's house there first. And
that means Dr. Jefferson came sometime in the 40s.
No, he came in the
50s.
I think I opened up. It was in the late 40s, early 50s mm-hmm. when he came.
Uh-huh. Where did he go? Did he leave?
He left. Mm-hmm. And I think they went to New York after they left here. Yeah.
Just a side issue, you know. You probably heard Dr. Bass say that he'd never been able to influence anybody to go into medicine. He was his jubilant over a little hall.
Oh, yeah.
He said, finally, you got somebody from Cincinnati going into medicine.
Well, Dr. Clark was still practicing, too.
Oh, yeah.
When I came here, when I was a child. Mm. He was still practicing.
about these businesses now. You came up to about into the 50s on your businesses. Do you remember Mrs. Goodman's?
Oh, yes. Oh, I'm sorry. I forgot about Mrs. Goodman. Yes, she had her business also on Harriet Street. Right. She had a very nice business there, a boutique, beauty shop, the whole bit. It was very nice. She used to give a lot of fashion shows and had a very nice established business. And then there was the restaurant on Harriet, right across from where Mrs. Goodman was. Present building that Omita is in.
Yeah.
And that was a very nice restaurant. And then the Cartwrights.
Oh, yeah.
But it was Reverend Cartwright, first family. And then there was, of course, the Bluebird Cab Company. Mr. Fleming's. Oh, yeah. Started right at Mr. Fleming's. Very well established when I was a kid. He used to work out of his apartment there in Park Ridge, where all of us lived in Park Ridge housing.
Right.
My father was the first family that lived in Park Ridge housing. And then came Reliable Cab. Mr. Al Taylor started that. And they had very good companies, because cabs, of course, were very important then, because there was a lack of cars, right? And then a group of men, a corporation, built an excellent restaurant there on the corner of Harriet and Hamilton called The Place. It was an excellent place. And it was sold out after urban renewal. You could go there, and it was like a soda fountain and full-course meal. It was, when they first opened it, it was elegant. You felt like dressing up to go there when they first opened it.
Do you remember the names?
The persons who established it.
Yeah.
Leonard Morgan, Don Taylor. Those were the two main investors. There were others, but those were the two major investors, Don Taylor and Leonard Morgan.
That one I hadn't heard.
Mm-hmm. And of course, Mrs. Mahaley.
Oh, yeah.
She had her night spot there, or club, whatever you want to call it. And then it was also a drugstore. She had
Was that her and her husband, or was that after her husband died?
You mean the drugstore?
Yeah.
I think it was developed before her husband died. Because I think after her husband died, I forget the man's name who took it over and ran it.
Mm-hmm.
But it was run there for quite a while. It was a nice place, too. Very nice place. And then Amos Washington had a grocery store right across the street on Harriet from Mrs. Mahaley's business there.
Yeah.
It was the Washington family that ran a grocery store there, which was always nice. And, well, so there were really quite a number of black businesses, and they were all quite well established and well run, well equipped. A lot of them faded out with urban renewal, and then a lot of them faded out because of whatever, I don't know.
One of the interesting aspects of that, of course, is that when they were starting these businesses, they were not able to go downtown like white folks and borrow large amounts of money. That these people finance these things themselves.
Well, that's true. Capital. That's true. But even so, as I recall, each one of these businesses I've named, the co-op store, Mr. May's store, all those places, the drugstore, Mr. Washington's store, Mrs. Goodman's shop, all those places were all well equipped.
Yeah.
They were well built. They were
nice.
Nicely run place.
Which means that these people had to be very frugal in order to get the money.
They were putting the finance back into
into
their businesses.
And see, we all know when you get into particularly white businesses, they go into business, but they always operate on somebody else's money.
No, that's true.
Our business will operate on their own money.
True. And they did a good job. Mm-hmm. I remember all of them.
Mm-hmm. Well, that interests me because I particularly been interested in developing the subject of black business. In fact, our next meeting is going to be discussing full economic base and economic changes that are taking place for the black people. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? Turning from business into education. Now, how do you remember that? That's been interesting to me because I learned that we had a graduate from Eastern in 1915, but who never was able to get a job teaching. And then I began to pick up Gene Beatty. Came here in around 1935, but he gives me the name of a woman who was here before him, one woman, and she evidently looked like she was white, but she eventually left and went to Detroit, where she has returned. But then from the time you came here, what about education then? Because evidently the only person that you would have known that was black in education would have been Gene Beatty, huh? Or was anybody else?
When I came here, all my teachers were black.
Oh, you, yes. Because you went to Paris School.
Yes.
Yeah, you went to Paris School, right.
So it's not
yes.
true.
Yeah. Well, this, now I'll get my story mixed up because Gene said he was, said until, well, when he came in, he served under a white principal. But then when he became principal, then he began to get the blacks in. I think that's the way it was or something like that. But everybody was at Perry.
Yeah, all the teachers at
all
that
the black
time.
Teachers mm-hmm. were at Perry.
They were at Perry.
And then only later did they begin to scatter out through the
right.
school system.
Right.
But that's... And then, of course, the other thing, let me back up for a moment. In talking about businesses, because it's one of the businesses you didn't talk about, and that was your own business.
Well, you were talking about when I was a child.
Well, I'm talking about as you grew up. I'm talking about starting when you were a child.
Oh, I was
starting
just naming off
were,
all those that no, were
just
established
when, you
when
were
I was
child.
A child.
Starting when you were a child and coming on up to the present time, because you know they get the Forbes Construction Company.
No, because I thought you meant you only wanted to hear who was in business when I was a child.
No, I mentioned the whole period.
Well, then I missed a
Anything
lot of them in between
remember.
Because Tom Hall ran a service station on Huron Street. Then you know of all the barbershops that were finally established on Harriet. Tom Hall also had a car wash on Michigan Ave for quite
yeah,
a long time.
I remember
time.
That.
Then you got Tom Hall's lawn services, his nephews who are in the lawn business. And of course, my husband who went into his own construction company, Forbes Construction. And that's been about 16 years, I guess. He was in that. Then there, I'm trying to think of other people who were into businesses.
Well, other than back. Johnny, because Johnny came.
Of course, Johnny Barfield started as, you know, with his janitorial service.
He used I've gotten him on tape about
and
his.
So then from there, he's branched.
Mm.
And then, Forbes Party Store became a reality. We were there for 6 years. Now L&M Supplies across the street from Forbes.
Oh, is that yours?
Sure.
I didn't know that.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Wait a minute. I haven't been in the other store since you sold it.
I haven't been in there too much.
Right.
And then, of course, Joe Richardson bought the party store on Washington Street.
Mm-hmm.
Joe's Party Store. Now it has a new owner.
Mm-hmm.
That's about it.
Well, of course. Well, there are some others that I already have.
Right there.
But you are mentioning a lot of them that I would have missed, and because I know about that.
Allen Supermarket.
Store, the Bop.
Oh yeah, the
store.
Bop Shop. Fred Woods and the Bop Shop.
Yeah.
Allen Supermarket. There used to be Allen Supermarket on Huron Street. an excellent store, the Allen family. They relocated back to Inkster after the urban renewal went through the area there, mm-hmm. and the highway went through, mm-hmm. and they own a large supermarket in Inkster. I mean, like large, one of the old A&B buildings, like.
My face brightened up because, as you said that, it reminded me of something. When I first joined the Business and Professional League, that was an island who was a member of the, had been a member. I never met him, but I remember seeing a record of an island who was a member. And Allen had paid his membership into the Business and Professional League 2-3 years before I got here, and somehow they hadn't deposited his check.
And there was the check.
Yeah. And I remember taking it back to the club, and they just decided to let it go because he was no longer here. No, but he was somebody I never knew. But I never quite understood how that thing happened. But now I see.
That probably was Mr. Allen, mm-hmm. the father. Mm-hmm. It was a family, yeah. run business. The father, mother, sons, daughters, mm-hmm. the whole bit. Mm-hmm. And they still run a successful business mm-hmm. in Inkster.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's an aspect of life, of course, that interests me because I think the vibrancy of a community can be measured in terms of how of its entrepreneurs, mm-hmm. really, mm-hmm. Because these are people who have to put something back in, and they sort of serve as a base for all of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I've never had any regrets about it. I've always thought that it was a place to live in, a good place to live in. The schools, I never had any upsets about the schools as far as I was concerned. And I always had excellent teachers when I was at Perry. Of course, it was Harriet Street then.
Yeah.
And there were a lot of good influence on me. And when I went back there to teach, quite a number of them were still there. And I think it's because of them that I probably stayed in education, because they made it sound good and made things interesting for me to want to stay, because they were so helpful.
You're glad you stayed in education.
Mm-hmm. I have no regrets. I don't know anything else. I my second choice would have been going into some business. I would have, for me to be happy in business, I would have had to been an executive at GM, Ford's, or somewhere. And I probably could have done it if I had pushed to do it. But after I started in education, I just became satisfied with it. And then after I got married, I was very satisfied with it, because I knew, I was happy with it.
Yeah.
I've had no regrets with the 24 years of it. It's been quite nice.
Yeah. I was a librarian for 41 years.
No, really?
And I don't regret it yet.
Yeah, I don't think I can stay that long, but I'm sure I can. I know it does.
It slips up on you.
It doesn't seem as though it's been 24 years for me.
I came right out of school and went right on to library school. And 3 years later, I got married. Well, 2 years after I was out of library school, got married. And the next thing I knew, I was a library administrator, and I went down south. And it's been a good life for me.
Mm-hmm.
And when as Ruth and I often do, we can't ever forget that background. And we look at what we've done, I think you tend to measure yourself against your background, or measure yourself against your parents. In our case, I think we do a little both. And where they were, mm-hmm. how far they had come. Mm-hmm. And then we look at what we've done, and we say, well, they provided a foundation for us, and we've done pretty good with that foundation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's how I feel, too. Yeah. I think that my parents gave us the best.
But without that foundation, you don't know what would have happened.
That's true.
I think that's where.
Yeah, I think we were very fortunate.
Mm-hmm.
We had the best parents, and we still have the best father with us.
Yeah.
So we've been very fortunate.
Yeah,
we've gotten nothing but encouragement to try to succeed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's my buddy. But as I I guess the other thing that I wanted to get you on to, you've been an observer also of the political process.
That's one subject I never discuss.
Well,
I don't know that much about it because I've never really been involved in politics.
Yeah.
I vote on voting day and that's it.
Do you remember the first city alderman, councilman?
I don't remember the first one. I heard that it was Frank Seymour.
Right.
I remember Mr. Seymour vaguely, but I never really knew him. You know, because I, at that time, I was in school and sports and working.
Yeah.
I never really paid it that much attention.
Yeah.
But I remember who Mr. Seymour was. I remember when he was in office, and I remember it was a big thing.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, I don't have that great recollection.
Mm.
But I knew it was Frank Seymour.
What did you do when you were in high school?
What did I do?
What activities were you in?
Well, I was in drama club. I was definitely into sports because I've always loved sports. Played every girl's sport there was. Yearbook staffs, future teachers club. The boosters group.
Well, those at least were the principal ones. And then how much of that was transferred to college?
I went to Eastern.
Yeah.
But I wasn't involved in anything at Eastern because I had to work.
Mm-hmm.
And so I didn't have time for all that other stuff. So I was never on anything at Eastern except I led sorority.
Oh, yeah.
And I wasn't that active in that. And it still isn't. So when I went to Eastern, I went to school full time, took full credits, and I worked full time. So I didn't have time.
You didn't have time.
All that. My thing was to get through Eastern and get out and get to work.
Did you do your master's at Eastern?
Mm-hmm. And specialist. Yeah.
I thought you finished Eastern, but so many people go to Eastern and then go to the university.
No, I never saw the university offering that much in education. Mm-hmm. That would make me change.
Mm-hmm.
Eastern, to me, have a better school for that.
Because Vanzetti was another person who did that, came through Eastern and got his master's at Eastern, I think, yeah.
That's mm-hmm.
right. Before he went into law school.
Right.
He went to law school, University of Michigan.
Right. Now, if I had changed my area or something like that, or if I had gone on for a PhD or whatever, of course, I would have transferred. But I started working on a PhD, and I said, I didn't see it.
Mm.
So I ended up getting an EDS, and that was enough for what I'm going to do.
Well, tell you my story. I put in 2 years. With the objective of getting a PhD. And the thing that stopped it was a job came along.
Well, I started weighing what I would do with a PhD. Nothing. NOTHING, nothing. And as far as I would be going in Ipsy Public Schools, the EDS was enough.
Yeah.
That's as far as I was going. Because I knew I'm not going to go to the university level. And nowadays, I know I'm not. So that was enough.
Somebody offered you a professorship?
No way. That wouldn't interest me at all.
You like working with kids?
I like working with the children, and then when I finish that, I'm going to be through with it, period. I'm not going to look for any other job other than my own personal business, working in my own personal business. That would be enough. Home and my personal business.
Of course, we have a lot of pride, and I think there's a lot of pride in people like you who choose to stay and work with people like that. At least, I know there is a lot of pride in because I know of other people who have chosen to do likewise, and in some cases even turned down administrative positions in order to make their contributions where it really counts. On the other hand, you have some people who, I guess, follow Peter Gunsman.
I really feel as though I'm not a powerful person. And so I feel I have to do my little thing just being naturally me. and I can do that within the profession and without the profession. And I think perhaps in many cases I probably do more without the profession than I do within. Because within, you're in your limits of your job description and all that kind of thing. You can make some impacts, but to me, I make more impact on people and needs of people just being me, the person.
About your rewards.
Awards?
Rewards.
What rewards?
Rewards from what you do.
I have personal rewards.
The rewards. Yeah, that's what I'm talking about, the personal reward, not the financial anything.
I just personally feel that if we have an opportunity to have some type of enlightenment, that it's not something that you wear on your shoulders, you know, that, or you look at, I don't even know where my degrees are, you know.
Yeah.
That kind of thing doesn't bother me. I got those because the law said I had to have them to do the job. Mm-hmm. So mine is to see particularly young people that I have come in contact with as a teacher or a friend or just knowing them in the community, and to see some of them become contributing individuals, no matter what their jobs are, or if they're unemployed, at least they're within the law, you know, and they're influenced somewhat by religion. Maybe a few of them who still remind me, they're up in their 20s and their 30s, and they remind me that I spanked them one day about something, but they remembered it. So it must have, that spanking must have done something. If they're 20 and 25 years old and they still remember, I spanked them in the first grade. So, and I tell them, I said, good, that's the best thing you can tell me. You remember that spanking. If you never get another one, you remember that one.
Of course, to me, that's what I mean. I think that's the greatest reward.
To me, it's great. That's the best.
About 3 weeks ago, I had a young man from Detroit sit in my kitchen at home, and he brought me a copy of his book. And he mentioned me in the press.
Mm-hmm.
To me, that's the greatest talent reward I can get.
That's right.
Because I had so much of an influence on him when he was at Lincoln that years later, that he should remember that and say, I want to remember this man, and I remember this man and what he did for me.
A lot of my students remember me as being a strict disciplinarian.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll say, boy, you didn't play around when Miss Woods came by. Or some of them remember me in my maiden name. Mm-hmm. Boy, Miss Olu, I remember when you used to get on us about doing so and so. But perhaps by my getting on them then made them better people today, you know. And I'm glad they remember it.
Yeah.
And they remember when I made them stay after school or miss recess because they didn't complete assignments or they didn't take time to try to learn. Because I used to tell them, I worked too hard preparing myself to try to impart this knowledge. You all better sit out here and learn something. I mean, I'm not wasting the state's time. And I tell them just like that. Came here to waste my time. You get on up and get out of here. And they'll tell you in a minute. So those things, and remembering the kids, like there are very few students that I taught that can walk in here today and they might be 30 years old. And I might have taught them when they were 6, and I bet you I could tell you their name. Because they were so important.
Yeah.
And very few of them. And they look at me and they'll say, how do you remember me? You remember me? Yeah, because you were very important. And that's why I always tell, like, student teachers when they come here or whenever I work with them, first thing you do, more so than listening to what I'm doing, learn the kids' names and learn which name belonged to Mary and which one. Because kids feel turned off when I'm John and you call me Jack.
That's right.
You know, they feel as though you're not really taking
name
any interest. So people's names, and to some people that's all they have is their name. And that's all they're going to ever have is their name. That's the way I used to look upon some of the kids at Terry. The most important thing you're going to ever have is your name. So let's make that a very important item.
This morning, this ain't got to do, a thing to do with kids, but we got a situation. We got a situation. I don't know. That's just one of those things that I don't know where I got it, where I picked it up.
Well, I've always felt that people's names, my mother taught us that, that people are too important to just take them for granted or to pass them over. My mother used to take 2 hours to walk from Park Ridge to downtown Ipswich. because she stopped and talked to everybody.
Yeah.
Spoke to everybody. And if it was a dog on the porch, she talked to the little dog or the cat. Mr. Jones, who might have been way back somewhere in the living room, she was looking for him.
Yeah.
So that taught us, and we used to fuss about it when we were kids. Oh, Mom, come on. But I find I'm the very same type of person as I've grown older, and I've always said I wouldn't be that way. But I find I stop and talk to the dogs, too, if they don't try to bite me. I'm more cautious than my mother is, you know. My mother didn't fear that people would harm her or mistreat her and that kind of thing. But I guess I'm a little bit more cautious about it.
Well, you're in a different day. You have to be a little bit more cautious now.
But
she came up in a time when people left the doors unlocked.
That's right.
Neighbors looked out for each other.
Well, we were that way, too. Mm-hmm. When we were growing up, you didn't have mistreat or misact or anything, because anybody was your disciplinary.
Yeah.
But I found, you know, as I grew older, things changed.
Yeah.
So you do react a little differently. Mm-hmm.
Do you remember, as you grew up here, do you remember the nice homes that black folks had?
Mm-hmm. Sure. The nicest homes, the two houses there on Harriet Street, one which the Basses bought. And
is that where they live now?
No. Dr. Bass
and
his wife, they ended up buying that house. And I can't identify who was in it before. I know the people, but I can't call their names that lived there prior to Mr. and Mrs. Bass buying it. And then right next door to that house there on Harriet was the Andrews. Mr. Andrews is one who date Mrs. Burton at your church.
Oh, yeah.
Okay,
yeah,
he and his family, first family, they were right next door. And that was two beautiful houses there. On Jefferson Street, Mr. and Mrs. Pete Brooks, they had a lovely place. The Goodmans, they always had a nice place. The Dennises on
Adams Street.
In fact, most of those houses right in that area there of Adams Street, right down to where John Burton presently lives, black people lived all the way down there to that point. Because I remember 211 South Adams was the last house that black people lived in, and that's right across from where John Burton presently lives.
Oh, yeah.
Those were all nice houses in comparison to, you know, houses of anybody. On Madison and Jefferson, there were people that had nice houses at the time, the Ramseys on Madison, the Simpsons. Jefferson had a nice house. The Kennedys on Madison, the Kennedys on Jefferson. There was lots of nice houses. It was very, but then a lot of those generations kind of got older, and the area really needed developing because there were a lot of makeshift houses too. The Dorseys had a nice house on Jefferson, and that's led up to the period of time when urban renewal came in, which was not effective anyway. Didn't really develop the area, but was supposed to have. But there were Hawkins Street. Hawkins was a beautiful street.
The only reason I'm asking that question, I was in 1950 within the state. There was a big celebration of the 50 years of the Emancipation Proclamation. And a book was put out by an agency of the state. Actually, it was a special committee that was appointed. And in that, they were citing the progress of the Negro. And that was the word they used up to that time. And in this listing were nice homes of black people all over the state of Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
A large number of them were Ypsilanti.
Oh, were they up to? Ypsilanti was a black south side of Ypsilanti was beautiful.
Now, very few Ann Arbor.
Ann Arbor people just had a little packet on 4th Avenue, 5th Avenue, which were older, run down, more or less speak when they got it. But Ypsilanti, black people were spread it out, like from Washington, I mean, Watland Street, which is, you know, right by the expressway, right down to Michigan Ave, of course, coming north.
Yeah.
And then as far down as Washington, Huron, you know. And then there were people over on Prospect, over in that area. And people had nice houses.
Yeah.
First Avenue, those houses were very nice. The Curzies, you know, basically all lived on First and Second Avenue. And there were nice houses. It was nice. The area was nice.
Well, you know, that ties in with something else that I have noticed, and that is that there have always been thriving builders within this black community. The Curzies were only one.
The Basses?
Yeah, the Basses, I understand. In fact, I've interviewed Moles, and they have always been very proud builders, and their work was
excellent.
Well, the way somebody put it, I think it was Bass was telling me. He said sometimes when they would build for black people, they'd have to stretch out the collection of money.
Mm-hmm.
But they would make their money and with the white folks, which enables them to work for the black folks.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But then there was this area back up on First Street, on Second Avenue, that we used to call Curzieville, when the Curzies first got here. And then it seems that every time a child of the Curzies would get married, they'd give them a place.
Yeah, they'd stretch them another house out. Yeah. First, and then it became First and Second
Avenue.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
But now that all ties in, because you see, the other thing is that I knew already that when Brown Chapel was built, all three buildings, now Brown Chapel has actually had three buildings, but in all three buildings, the way they got them was to have meetings of members, and they'd come down with their hammers and their saws and they'd build.
Sure.
Well, Second Baptist was very much the same way, up until this last building.
Yeah.
I've gotten some pictures of Second Baptist, just like I got pictures of Brown Chapel, and these people came down there, and you would have one or two skilled craftsmen.
Mm-hmm.
And these other people would just come in there and work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember when I was a child, Second Baptist, my uncle, of course, was the minister there then.
Mm-hmm.
And these brothers, what were their names? There's two brothers.
Not the Bowles.
No. These people belong to Second Baptist. The last names was Mitchell. We call them the Mitchell brothers in Baptist.
Yeah.
And they both were tradesmen, and they would have work parties there on Saturdays.
Mm-hmm.
The little work that was done in that church,
mm-hmm.
Mr. Hamilton, Van Zetti's father, he was supposed to be a good tradesman.
Yeah.
Mr. Babs, I don't know if you heard that.
Yeah, I've heard that name, Babs.
All of those people would have their hammers and saws and down your work, and that's how all the work was done then.
Mm-hmm.
So I remember that very well.
In other words, that's the way, well, I think it's that kind of thing that has helped us to survive all over.
Right.
And then I think it did a little better in this community because there was a little bit more of it.
Yeah.
And
people in this community have always been more or less. You had your so-called influential groups,
mm-hmm,
you
mm-hmm.
always will have,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Yeah.
But, like, it was exclusive to be a member of Palm Leaf at one time, you know, that kind of thing, which is good, because you need those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
But people basically in this community have always been very common people, the majority. Now, when I was a kid growing up, we used to have rivalry between Second Baptist and Brown Chapel.
Yeah.
And we always, of course, had the majority of the youth at Second Baptist because Brown Chapel just didn't have that many children.
Baptist.
That's right. We were all Baptists. So it was more or less like the Baptist church against the Catholic church, if you really want to look at it, as far as black people were concerned.
Mm-hmm.
And we always had more going in our church.
Mm-hmm.
And they were more prim and proper. That's why now it's probably hard for me to accept you all over there clapping and shouting and knocking over benches because and hollering and making noise because we always did it. And when people that Brown Chapel wanted a little spirit, they came to Second Baptist. They didn't tell their friends they came, because that was a little underneath them, you know. We always did, and we always had youth groups. We always had Sunday school picnics. Whole community went on the Sunday school picnics. We'd have 3 and 4 and 5 Greyhound buses chartered. 6 go all over the place. That was a big time for everybody, not just the church. And it was always something to do. And then we would always go to church, go to BYPU, stay for the evening service, leave there and go on Hawkins Street to the Holiness Church.
Oh, yeah.
And watch the people dance and fall out and speak languages.
Unknown tongues.
See, they're doing that in the Baptist church. Yeah. Now. So we don't have to go to the Holiness Church. Well, that just shows how things change. But we used to, and the minister used to talk about us, and never will forget Elder Anderson. At the church right across from SL's there on Hawkins.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh, that man used to talk about us. He made us feel as though we were the dirt of the earth. But we go back every Sunday night and let him talk about us again. Because he talked about us wearing makeup and being unholy and that kind of thing. Even right up until he had both legs amputated eventually. Huh. And then before he died. And we were crazy about it. Man would treat us so bad and talk about us so bad in the service. Then after the service was over, he treated us nice. Mm. You know, he was nice to us.
Yeah.
But that was his job, to try to make us repent.
Yeah.
And we had left our church, and that was our Sunday night entertainment, to go over there. It was fun.
Well, that just shows you how similar places are. Well, that was the way we got our entertainment, too.
Another thing we used to do, too, when my uncle was there as the minister, he was crazy about young people. Mm. And he made sure wherever he traveled, he took the youth church or our choirs, youth choirs, and wherever he exposed us, wherever. Mm. And we had a lot of movement in that church. There was never a dull moment. There was plenty to do. Mm-hmm. And it was fun, and we used to always want to take turns riding in the car with him, because he'd speed.
Yeah.
Police would stop him and sit there and listen to him tell all these stories to the police while he was speeding. Get away with it. And we just got the biggest thrill out of Uncle Garth, the speeding, and getting the ticket. But and then we want to ride with him the next time. Mm-hmm. And hear him give that jolly laugh to the police. And
are any of his children anything like him? Mm-hmm. Is SL?
SL is like him. Very much like him. SL tries hard to be like his father, in fact. Garther Jr. is like him. In fact, all of them are like him. They're very warm, nice people. He was just a very warm, kind man. And he went out of his way for, you know, like SL takes a lot of influence with the courts and all.
Yeah.
Well, boy, that poor man kept a lot of people out of Jackson prison. My uncle did. Go to the judges. Everybody knew him. When they'd see him coming.
He and Brakey were very good.
Oh, nice. Lord, yeah. But Brakey was sending them away like grit and dirt on the beach.
They say Brakey would say, "You go to church?" "Yes, sir." "Well, where do you go to church?" "I go to Second Baptist." "Well, I'll have to confirm with them ropes about that."
Yep. That's true.
And said if he found that they did, he'd turn them over to Reverend Ropes.
Yeah.
And if they didn't, and they promised to go,
he had a lot of trouble. Yeah. He spent a lot of time helping people. Lots of time, and the people downtown all knew him.
Yeah.
He spent a lot of time trying to make things right for people.
I've heard good things about him. Lots
He's
of good,
a good
things.
Man.
I've been very impressed.
Fought most his wars with a smile.
Mm-hmm. Now he is your uncle on your maternal
brother.
Side.
Yeah, yeah. My mother's brother.
Mm-hmm.
So the Robersons are my relatives on her side.
Yeah. Well, because I think a lot of both Garth and Luke, the only two I really know, because I know your mother. Mm-hmm. But I know Garth and I know SL, and I plan to interview both of them if I help catch them.
lot of Robesons.
One more?
This has been an interesting.
Well, I hope it's helpful to you.
I haven't visited with you in a long time.
One of these days I'm going to write my memoirs.
Yeah, that'd be nice.
One of these days.
That'd be nice. Well, anyway, I don't tell you I won't be back because one of the things that I...